خب خیلی خوشبختم و افتخار میکنم که دعوت شدم که در مملکتی که بالاخره این همه وقت از زندگی رو گذروندم بتونم صحبت کنم. متاسفم که نمیتونم شخصا اونجا باشم، ولی امیدوارم یکی از این روزا بتونم برای مدتی برگردم و شاید با همتون ملاقات بکنم و رو در رو صحبت کنم با شما از مسائلی که براتون ممکنه جالب باشه، فلسفه و ریلاتیویسم و پروژه جدیدم که کاملا یک موضوع جدایی است از موضوع ریلاتیویسم. متاسفانه چون البته من در ایران درس خوندم، در اوائل دبیرستان در ایران تمام کردم، حتی دانشگاه تهران هم 2 سال درس خوندم ولی نه فلسفه، ولی چون فلسفه رو فقط در غرب یاد گرفتم فقط به انگلیسی میتونم فلسفه بنویسم یا صحبت کنم. اینه که خیلی متاسفم که نمیتونم به فارسی این پیپر رو برای شما بدم. جلوی یکی از این روزا اگه عمری باقی باشه بتونم یه خود یاد بگیرم که بتونم افکار فلسفی رو هم به فارسی بیان بکنم، ولی فعلا این امکان برام وجود نداره. ولی به من گفتن که شما هم شما همه میتونید این پیپر انگلیسی رو دنبال بکنید و برها من بیشتر موضوعات پیپر رو روی این پاورپوینت گذاشتم. اینه که هرچی که میگم به انگلیسی اونجا هم بیشترش نوشته شده و در ضمن پاورپوینت هم ما هم ایمیل کردم، به خصوص این که خیلی نگرانم که این کنکشن ممکنه قطع بشه، چون من مجبور شدم برگردم به منزل و از منزل سکایپ بکنم و خب البته وای فای منزل به خوبی وای فای دانشگاه نیست. اینه که اگه مشکلی به وجود اومد در حال پاورپوینت هم رو دارید شما و انشالله میتونید از اون استفاده کنید. در حال الان من دیگه این پیپر رو شروع بکنم به اسم Value of Relativism و در انگلیس به انگلیسی زبان به من پروفسور ماریا باگرامیان میگن. ایران که بودم البته ماریا باگرامیان میگفتن و هر دو در حال حاضر صحیح هستن از نظر اسم من. So this paper is a response to an old puzzle, a puzzle that was expressed well by Alistair MacIntyre back in 1985 in a quotation that has been repeated many times. I've quoted this passage and used it in various publications, and so have others. So the passage reads, "Relativism, like skepticism, is one of those doctrines that have by now been refuted a number of times too often. Nothing is perhaps a surer sign that a doctrine embodies some not-to-be-neglected truth than that in the course of history of philosophy it should have been refuted again and again. Genuinely refutable doctrines only need to be refuted once." So my question is, why is it that relativism is resurrected from the dead? Why is it that we cannot refute relativism once and for all, or resurrect it once and for all? Why is it that it emerges to death and from death? So we can look at this question in different ways. We can maybe respond to the question why relativism cannot be killed off by saying that relativism has survived because it's a genuine response to the puzzling case of intractable disagreement. This is what the relativists say. Relativism should stay alive, not only be resurrected, but should stay alive because it's a genuine attempt to respond to a genuine question and a genuine difficulty, namely the difficulty of why is it that certain types of disagreements persist and cannot be resolved. That response has a couple of issues or faces two problems, to be more specific. Firstly, if you take relativism to have a broad scope, like as in Protagorean relativism, the anti-relativists argue that relativism should not survive because it is an incoherent position. And that, as you all know, I'm sure, is the sort of position that was taken up by playful and has been repeated time and again. If you take the question of why relativism cannot be killed off in a narrow scope and ask why is it that certain types of relativism have survived, for instance, semantic relativism of recent times, relativism was predicate of taste, for instance, or even moral relativism only, then that sort of relativism, the so-called new relativism, as far as I'm concerned, is really not an interesting philosophical doctrine. It is really a doctrine about a limited number of predicates, particular predicates of taste, and then moral predicates are treated as being similar to predicates of taste. And to me, that makes relativism a survivable, but a very boring doctrine. So those two answers, I don't think, work very well. So instead, I would like to propose a different response to the question why relativism has survived. The proposal here is that relativism has survived because it, as a doctrine, presented as a doctrine, has specific aims and functions which are frequently mischaracterized as or misunderstood. So this paper basically argues fundamental message is that if you want to understand the survival of relativism, you have to understand or take a look, close look and a fresh look at relativism itself. And I'll go through the various arguments for that. So here is the structure of my paper. In section one, I argue that relativism should best be seen as a strategy or what Bas van Praten has called a stance for dealing with profound differences and intractable disagreements in the cognitive and evaluative domains rather than a thesis. So I'm going to argue that relativism should not be seen as a doctrine or a thesis. This is contrary to what I have argued in my Relativism 2004 or my Relativism 2015 in Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. I gesture towards this new position in the latest book that's coming out next month, but I'll come back to that later. So that's section one. In section two, I argue that the relativistic stance is often defended or either implicitly or explicitly with reference to a number of intellectual and moral virtues that are purportedly fostered by the stance. So if you want to understand why relativism survives, you have to look at its consequences, which are cashed out by many, and we'll see some examples of that, cashed out by many in terms of intellectual virtues and moral virtues. Section 3 of the paper looks at the success of relativism at achieving these virtues, and I'm going to conclude that at best, at very best, their success is mixed. In fact, I'm going to say that it's not successful, but I'm just being nice to the relatives and saying that there is a bit of success. Then in section 4, I look at the ways in which Martin Kusch has disagreed with these arguments, and I'll highlight two of his core criticisms of my original paper. I will then give a response to Kusch. So the first three parts of this paper can be found in my The Virtues of Relativism of the Aristotelian Society. By the way, is everything working okay from your end? Yeah, okay. So the first three sections are really replications by and large with some changes of my arguments from the joint session paper. But section four is based on Martin's presentation at the joint session, and I'm actually going to display some of his PowerPoints from the joint session, which I don't think he has shared those yet. But I'm sure it's okay for me to share them with you. They were shared at the joint session of the Aristotelian Society and Mindless Association. Then section five are my responses to Kusch. These are new. They have not been shared either. So the first three parts some of it have been actually published by Kusch and Bagramian. But the final section is new. All right, so I'm just going to time myself from now on, and I'm aiming to finish before 2 o'clock my time. That's you know, in about 50 minutes or so. So, like most papers, at least in the analytic tradition, we are going to start with some quick definitions. Now, this is going to get me into trouble as far as Push is concerned, because, as we'll see, his main criticism of my paper is dependent on the rejection of one of my definitions, and that's where he and I disagree strongly. But let's get on with my definition. So what is relativism? Relativism, I contend, involves the assumption that truth, justification, rationality, etc. of judgment varies with and depends on some possibly hidden parameters or frameworks. So this is the dependence thesis. Additionally and crucially, I argue that relativism is committed to what Bogosian in 2006 has called the equal validity thesis. Now, Bogosian was not the first person to propose this. Crispin Wright has had arguments like that and various other people. It's just that Bogosian managed to encapsulate this commonly accepted position about relativism into this in this nice expression, equal validity. So the claim of equal validity is that there can be more than one equally true, rational, or justified, but mutually incompatible judgments on any given topic or within a domain of discourse. So that's the equal validity thesis. And I'm arguing that to understand relativism, you have to accept that it involves dependence. If something is relative to something else, that's the dependence thesis, that just goes without saying, and then additionally an equal validity thesis. And that's a bit more contentious. What about intellectual virtues? What are these stuff we call intellectual virtues that have been the topic of so much discussion in recent social epistemology and virtue epistemology? So intellectual virtues are positive habits of thought. They are cognitive dispositions and practices that turn us into good thinkers. So the origins of this, of course, goes back to Aristotle, particularly he talked about moral virtues. But if you read Aristotle carefully, you see that he was also talking about intellectual virtues. So virtue theoretic approaches can be applied to ethics and can be applied to epistemology. But the strength of the approach, as far as I'm concerned, is that they marry epistemic and moral virtues together in certain areas very successfully. And that's why I like this approach very much. It sort of does away with the sharp distinction between the moral and the cognitive. But that's a debate for another day. So as opposed to epistemic virtues, epistemic vices are character traits, attitudes, and thinking styles that inhibit good thinking. So if you're a vicious intellectual in this sense, not that you're doing bad intellectual things, it's just that you're thinking badly. You're not performing your intellectual duties well, even if it's for a good cause. So if you want to be a good contributor to the epistemic economy of a society, you have to be a virtuous thinker. Otherwise, you won't be able to achieve your ends, the intellectual ends that you have, even if those intellectual ends are morally noteworthy. So let's start section one by looking at some background assumptions about metaphilosophies of relativism. What's the job of philosophy? How are we to answer the question, what is philosophy? So there are many, many answers to this question, obviously, but I'm going to focus on two different and very broad ways of answering the question, what is philosophy for? One answer is to say that philosophy's job is to discover and diagnose conceptual problems and offer solutions to them. That's what analytic philosophers chiefly do. We try to look at issues in any domain of discourse, from the highest and most abstract, such as metaphysics, to something like philosophy of sport. We diagnose conceptual problems and we offer solutions. So philosophy, seen in this light, is in problem-solving business, and relativism then, if you see it as a problem-solving attempt, at least to say to, has been found to be incoherent. So because it doesn't, when it tries to solve a particular problem, namely the problem of intractable disagreement, for instance, it ends up contradicting it. But there is another way of looking at what philosophy does. That is, there is a second meta philosophy, philosophical approach to relativism. In the second approach, philosophy's job is to provide a guide, i.e. a framework or set of tools for thinking and living better. This sort of philosophy of life approach. And if you accept that this is the aim of philosophy, I argue that relativism is often presented to us by at least some key defenders as a tool for living and thinking better. And I'll explain this later as I go through the papers. But this sort of, but you can have both of these approaches. So if you think of Pironian versus Cartesian skepticism, their topic in both cases is skepticism. Pironian skeptics were not just in the business of solving a philosophical problem, but they were also proposing a way of living, that is, giving up on things, suspending judgment, entering a form of tranquility or ataraxia, while dealing with skepticism. And if you compare that to Cartesian skepticism, Descartes was offering solutions to skepticism, but he was not offering a way of life through his solutions to skepticism, or at least not very obviously the way the Pironian skeptics did. So I'm claiming that relativism can also be seen in these two lights, as relativism can be seen as a philosophical problem that you try to resolve or dissolve, and it hasn't been very successful if we take Plato and everyone else seriously. Or we can look at relativism in line with something that the Pironians were trying to do, but in a different way. That is, relativism tries to teach us a way of living or being. So if we look relativism, if you take relativism as a guide and not just a doctrine, my proposal is that then relativism should be seen as a philosophical stance which gives rise to a number of epistemic and ethical attitudes. So what is a philosophical stance? Many of you may be familiar with this. The idea goes back to Basler Strassen, as he was the person who formulated it quite succinctly and clearly. According to Van Frassen, the circumstances are clusters of attitudes and epistemic strategies that do include propositional attitudes such as beliefs and hopes, but also incorporate intentions, commitments, and values. So it's not that, if you take relativism as a stance, it's not that there are no truth evaluable beliefs involved in relativism, but there is more to relativism than just truth evaluable propositional attitudes, such as beliefs. There are also intentions, commitments, and value judgments. And that's the line I'm going to pursue in trying to understand relativism better in this talk. So here is Van Frassen in the picture taking a stance. He seems a bit befuddled, a bit confused by his stance, but there you are, that sort of typical philosophical stance. Not I'm talking about his physical posture, but what is it that he says about his stance? He says, a philosophical position can consist in a stance, attitude, commitment, approach, a cluster of such, possibly including some propositional attitudes such as beliefs as well. Such a stance can, of course, be expressed and may involve or presuppose some beliefs as well, but cannot be simply equated with having beliefs or making assertions about what there is. So that's from Van Frassen, 2002, page 47. So what is a stance? Here is a cluster of definitions and comments that I think captures the notion of stance in philosophy. A philosophical stance manifests itself in terms of approaches that are felt congenial or promising. So emphasis on the notion of felt, not just belief, but felt to be congenial or promising. They are they also cohere with an agent's other values. This is again from Hans Francis. And again from Hans Francis, they're analogous to conversion to a cause. They're analogous to a religion or an ideology. Chakraborty, on the other hand, he has some sympathies for both pluralism and for the Dorsthoff's stance. He says that stances or intellectual policies or strategy for achieving one's epistemic goals. Boucher also says that stances are ways of seeing facts, which suggest questions and lines of inquiry illuminate important, therefore neglected or underappreciated issues. There are a broad set of perspectives or orientations towards both intellectual and ethical issues, which is justified by its epistemic truths. So it's their results that justify a stance or basis. So my argument is that these definitions, this cluster of definitions, capture relativism very well. And they all apply to relativism as a stance. Why? Because relativists are committed to the idea of the plurality of values and perspectives. So they have a commitment. When you're a relativist, you have a commitment. They also affirm the diversity of incompatible ways of thinking and living and show great sympathy for it. I don't think you find any relativist, of course, it's always dangerous to generalize like that, but you won't find many relativists who would say that, well, they would accept that they are relativists and then they will have contempt for different forms of life. It just doesn't go, the two don't go together. Relativists also show disdain from strong claims of objectivity and absolutism and find them rooted in ethnocentric and xenophobic tendencies. And I'll have examples for you for this so that you know that I'm not making it up as I go along. I am actually capturing something that is expressed by card-carrying committed relativists. Relativists also deny that it makes sense to think of the world as wholly mind-independent and independent of our beliefs, and they recommend a perspectival attitude. And crucially, they recommend the relativist stance as an intellectual strategy because they believe that its adoption, the adoption of this stance, could engender valuable cognitive and moral virtues. So, just a quick sidestepping of the issue. The whole idea of a stance has been criticized by Peter Lipton, the late and much missed Peter Lipton, criticized Van Straten, saying that, well, stance empiricism leads to relativism. And that may be right, and that would be a devastating criticism of stance empiricism, but it won't be a criticism of what I am proposing. Because if stances are relativistic, then so much the better for stance relativism, because then the standard self-contradiction principle of relativism has been blocked. So it's okay for stance relativism to be relativistic because it protects relativism as a stance from the charge of self-refutation. I just wanted to make that point to put it aside, so to block the sort of criticism that might arise from Peter Lipton's thinking about Van Fassel's notion of stance. And then the second question, well, okay, you're claiming that relativism is a stance, and we'll look at that a bit more in a minute. Why should we adopt such a stance? Why should we not just leave it aside? One point to notice is that stances, like other policies and guidelines, can be compared and assessed in virtue of the outcomes they generate and the understandings they offer. So you evaluate a stance and adopt it or reject it based on, as I said before, the fruits it bears. So, but also if you look at their internal coherence, but most importantly, this case, you evaluate them in terms of whether they achieve their goals or not. So someone like Tim Williamson will jump up down at this stage and say, well, what about truth? Where is the notion of truth? And the stance relativist does not put aside the notion of truth or does not need to put aside the notion of truth because, as I mentioned earlier, beliefs and propositional attitudes are components of a stance and they are truth evaluable, but they constitute only one element of the greater mix that characterizes a particular stance. So there are truth evaluable elements in any stance, including a relativist stance, but the claim is that that's not the whole story. So, if this is correct, if relativism can be seen as a stance, then we have a new way of looking at relativism. Now, the funny thing was that, so I worked a great deal on this. I mean, for the joint session papers, you're invited 2 years in advance, and then you propose someone as your respondent. So I proposed Martin Kusch as a respondent because he was joking at the joint session saying that, oh, well, they found yet another village relativist. You know, so they bring me up, and if anyone wants a defense of relativism. It wasn't just that. I like Martin Kusch's work a lot, and he's a relativist that I can engage with. But the very funny thing was that when I sent the first draft of my paper to him back, of, I don't know, a year and a half ago, he wrote back and said, I wonder how much we are going to disagree, because just at this moment, I'm writing another paper, a different paper, where I'm arguing that relativism should be seen as a stance. So in fact, on that position, we agreed, and we never had a debate on that. So maybe somebody from the audience will challenge my position that relativism should be seen as a stance. I was hoping that Martin would do that. But in fact, his paper where he argues that relativism should be seen as a stance is coming out quite soon. He does it slightly differently from me, but not in any way that he and I would want to disagree on that point. So I didn't get the sort of response I was looking for on this topic. So maybe you will be the people who will disagree with me on this question of whether relativism is a stance or a thesis, or maybe both. So the traditional proponents of relativism seem to assume that their stance results in cultivation of certain epistemic virtues. Examples of such traditional proponents of relativism are feminist epistemologists, Paul Feyerabend, and the strong theorists in sociology of science, as well as literary theorists such as Barbara Herenstein-Smith. Also, I think many non-philosophical defenses of relativism are couched in this virtue epistemic term. Although the terminology of virtue epistemology may not be familiar to the person on the street, as they are called, but the way they defend relativism, and I've seen this among my students and among other people, the educated people who are not necessarily professional philosophers, they defend relativism in virtue epistemic terms, thinking that relativism produces some intellectual goods that are also moral goods. So I think you can find a number of defenders of the virtues of relativism, as I call them. But let's look at one possible issue with this. So I'm proposing that there are virtues to relativism and that virtue relativists will base their defense of relativism on those grounds, and then a line of attack opens up claiming that, well, how could you even assume that there are such things as universal virtues? You're just denying a component of any relativistic doctrine, particularly moral relativism, that virtues, vices, any intellectual or moral attributes should be seen as relative. But I don't think that's a very good criticism of what I'm saying, because a consistent relativist should remain relativistic about virtues as well. But she can still argue that while these virtues are relative, they are shaped by the cultural or conceptual frameworks of both the relativist and the anti-relativist. So you can be a relativist, but agree that there are some intellectual traits, some truths even, some beliefs that are shared across various cultural or conceptual schemes. So I'm claiming that this debate arises in cases where the relativist and the non-relativist agree on what counts as virtue. Now, the relativist thinks that these virtues are relative, the non-relativist thinks that these virtues are universal, absolute, or whatever you want to call it. They are non-relative anyway, but that makes no difference in the debate. They both agree on the value of these virtues. So that was also a side point, just blocking a line of argumentation against what I'm trying to do here. So let's go back to the question I was posing right at the beginning, and I'm going to check the time. Okay. So why has relativism survived for such a long time? Well, my argument is that stances, unlike thesis, unlike doctrine, are not true or false to core, are not true or false once and for all, but they incorporate true or false beliefs which may be revised or abandoned without abandoning the stance itself. And this, if you look at relativism in this light, you will see that why relativism has been reformulated so frequently. So some criticism of relativism bites, and in those cases then relativism is reformulated while the stance is retained. Because all you need to do when you are holding a stance is to revise some components of it if you still believe and aim to hold the overall stance and its virtuous results. So the claim I'm making, and this applies to relativism as well as other stances, philosophical stances are not refuted once and for all. Rather, their ultimate defeat involves either the abandonment of the values and goals they aim to achieve, or an admission that these stances are not the right vehicle for achieving these goals or realizing the expected values. So you can't just prove relativism false, but if my argument is correct, by looking at some of the truly valuable beliefs incorporated into any relativist doctrine. You have to do something more than that. To defeat relativism, if that's what you want to do, is you need either to show that goals are no good, that should be abandoned, or that it doesn't contain it's not the right vehicle, right means of achieving these goals. And that's what I'm going to do in this paper, as I'm going to say that the goals are fine, but relativism is not the right vehicle for achieving those goals. So I promised a while back that I'll give you some real-life examples of the sort of relativists that I believe pursue the approach I am attributing to relativism. So here is Lorraine Coates, a famous feminist epistemologist and feminist philosopher, extremely good philosopher, so any criticism I have, with no disrespect to these figures, Code is really a genuinely a wonderful philosopher, but just that I disagree with her attitude towards relativism. So here's what Code said back in 1995, but she has repeated the view and has not changed her position. Mind you, she might have changed very recently. Since Trump came to power, people have changed their attitude towards relativism, because with Rudy Giuliani defending relativism, you know, who wants to be the company of Rudy Giuliani? But I haven't seen Coates recently, so I don't know where she stands very recently. But certainly in publications, she has defended relativism, because she says absolutism leads to often coercive views that we all see everything in the same way, and yet privileging some perspectives on knowledge. So you just look at the language, coercive view. Absolutism leads to coercion. By that, she means primarily intellectual coercion, but she actually also thinks that it could be political coercion. You have to excuse me for 1 second. I just noticed that my power is running out on this computer, and I need to make sure that it works again. So just 1 second, please. Yeah, I'm afraid there is a problem with the power here. Just 1 second, please. Can you still see me?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I just change the power socket, but okay. So this should be okay now. Right. All right. Good. So here is Kuhn's example. According to Kuhn, relativism is a defense against exactly the sort of coercion that she complains about, and this should be familiar to you from many other defenses of relativism. So ultimately, Kuhn thinks that feminists should come out in favor of relativism and they declare themselves relativists because that's how they can free themselves from the sort of intellectual coercion that has been ongoing in all over the world, actually, through male dominance. But it's not only feminist epistemologists or feminists who favor relativism for that reason. There are other examples as well. So here is a group of strong program, proponents of strong program. And David Bloor, for instance, claims that relativism is valuable because the rejection of absolutism encourages curiosity and limits dogmatism. And as you know, David Bloor was a member of the group that in Edinburgh that started the strong program in sociology time. And then another prominent example comes from Firebrand, who argued that the proliferation of theories is beneficial for science, while uniformity impairs its critical power. And also he linked that view to political positions and argued that uniformity also endangers the free development of the individual. So what it implies, what Firebrand implies by this point is that relativism leads to proliferation of theories and therefore it leads to better science. And also, it allows for human flourishing and human development. So it has both social and scientific value. But what is it that the relativists reject when they are arguing for this book? And the most common rejection point of relativism is
its contrast term or absolutism. The argument at first approximation and very quickly is that absolutism is morally and intellectually unacceptable, relativism is the rejection of absolutism, and hence relativism is a valuable position. So the value of relativism is established through its opposition to something that is morally and intellectually unacceptable. And I'm sure you have come across this argument in many places. Certainly, David Bloor, Barry Barnes, Martin Kush himself, they all talk about this absolutist as this bogeyman. But as we'll see, the problem with that is that it doesn't appear to be who the absolutists are, but that's another thing. So the problem with this is that absolutism, even more than relativism, is not just a single way, well-defined thesis or doctrine, but a blanket term for a host of subsidiary positions and commitments. So, when someone tells you or relativism should be contrasted with absolutism and relativism is the good thing and absolutism the bad thing, I think the first question you have to ask is, which absolutism are you talking about? Because absolutism, like relativism, has been defined in many different ways. And here is a bunch of definitions from Rescher, 2004. Absolutism has been identified with certainty, necessity, exactness, universality, timelessness, objectivity, in the sense of mind independence, commitment to unconditional, ultimate, or even transcendental truth, etc., etc. So, different relativist criticisms of absolutism prioritize one or more of the members of this cluster. So, for instance, if you take the cultural relativists, they reject the idea of universal truth or rationality. Moral relativists deny the objectivity or universality and universality of moral values. Post-Hegelian anti-absolutists are arguing about something else altogether. They are denying the idea of timelessness of truth and claims that then lead to historicist relativism. Polanyian anti-absolutists are, on the other, target the a priori and analytic truth resulting in conceptual relativity. So depending on how you understand absolutism, you might pair it with specific forms of relativism. But just thinking that there is this thing, absolutism, as contrasted with relativism, as a broad stroke, maybe it's an okay thing to say, but really needs to be investigated much more carefully before it becomes the standard bearer defense of relativism, as Kush has done. And this is where he and I really disagree with each other. But so, let's go back to the broad stroke definition of absolutism. What's wrong with absolutism? Why not be an absolutist? Most people just jump at the term absolutism because of its connections with the political domain. Going back to Louis XIV and his dictum, l'état c'est moi, state is me, absolutism in politics has become identified with the worst kind of political excesses and dictatorships possible. Also, in religion, absolutism has been seen as part of an unconditional obedience to one church or one holy book or one state, and that in many places criticized as an attitude towards life. But philosophical absolutism, on the other hand, the sort of absolutism that maybe we can attribute to Hegel or very different forms to Frege, they are not the sort of absolutism that we want necessarily to avoid. We can argue with Frege's strong Platonic realism, but it's not that there's something ethically wrong with Frege's absolutism. You might want to disagree with this, but I don't think Frege's realism, if you accept that it's an absolutist form of realism, I don't think it ends up being ethically objectionable. It's philosophically objectionable. And the same with Hegel on the absolute. should sharing absolutism with relativism just like that and saying that absolutism is bad and then therefore relativism is good is a very naive move. Absolutism is bad when it comes to politics and social mores, mores. We can maybe all agree on that. I hope you agree on that. I certainly believe that. But that's not the same thing as rejecting philosophical absolutism, if there is such a thing at all. That whole thing is open to debate. It's not clear that there is such a thing as philosophical absolutism. But if you take Frege, for instance, as the prime example of somebody who came close to an absolutist position about truth and about logic and the standing of logic and mind independence, etc., getting a negative vice out of that, intellectual or political vice out of that, is a bit difficult. Hilary Putnam, who up to his death was one of my closest mentors, for a period in 1990s tried to connect Frege's views on realism and logic to his anti-Semitism. But in fact, he even gave up on that, because there are many counterexamples to it. Many people who would hold Fregean views on truth and on status of mathematics and logic and won't be anti-Semitic, they'll actually could be pro. I think that position is really not tenable, although Martin Kirsch has made gestures towards it, but he hasn't produced any argument for it. He has just connected Frege, people make connections between Frege, his anti-Semitism and his realism, but nobody shows how the two connect with each other. So, what I have argued is that the virtues of relativism are aligned by its proponents with the rejection of the perceived vices of absolutism. But absolutism is a placeholder for a cluster of intellectual vices that are linked with anti-relativism. So let's look at these, some of these quickly. I think the most important one that should be highlighted is the vice of authoritarianism versus the intellectual virtue of tolerance. So here is Lauren Coates. She says, neither of relativism makes us allies of the authoritative and thus authoritarian discourse of scientism, and by association renders us dogmatic and narrow-minded. Conversely, relativism helps us counter epistemic as well as other forms of oppression by making us more tolerant of other standpoints and modes of thought, particularly those that we are inclined to reject. So basically, these statements by Coates encapsulate the sort of virtues that are attributed to relativism. And I'm absolutely certain that you have had any debate among yourselves between relativism and anti-relativism, these sorts of topics have come up. It's just a staple of conversations about relativism. So open-mindedness and tolerance are seen as part of being a relativist. Why is that? Well, relativism, it's argued, leads to open-mindedness, even about seemingly contradictory views, because you have to be open to both possibilities or all possibilities if you're a relativist, and such openness, in turn, can be intellectually and practically beneficial. So, Linda Zagzewski, for instance, has said that open-minded person, among other things, is successful at considering the idea of others, the ideas of others, including those that conflict with her own. So the relativist sort of makes herself open to various positions. So relativism, therefore, may be seen as a shortcut to success in this. Then also absolutist positions are identified with intellectual rigidity and chauvinism. It's argued that relativism, specifically cultural relativism, can counteract cultural chauvinism and ethnocentrism, because it makes us open to different cultural groups and historic periods and their viewpoints. also it has been argued either directly or indirectly that relativism can help us overcome intellectual arrogance. So, for instance, to quote from somebody that I haven't mentioned yet, Barbara Herenstein Smith, the last line on the PowerPoint says that the relativist accuses their opponents of the vice of dubious self-privilege. If you're an anti-relativist and you're an absolutist, Herenstein and others have said, you are privileging your views over others. That helps us to overcome power. So I won't go through the PowerPoint can be shared with you, and these are also in my article because I want to get to the sort of debate I have with Kush very soon. So there are more virtues that can be attributed to relativists, for instance, giving voice to the marginalized people and hence overcoming epistemic injustice. This is what Fricker, for instance, in her 2006 book has alluded to, but she's talking about a limited form of relativism, the Bernard Williams type of relativism, not relativism in general. And also David Bloor has argued that relativism leads to the virtue of intellectual curiosity and openness. So, but how good is the vice in this defense of relativism? Well, I have argued in my paper that relativism actually leads to some vices, and those vices, those intellectual vices, outperform the intellectual virtues that you might be able to attribute to relativism. One common accusation is that relativism undermines the value of truth and with it the virtue of truthfulness. And that's a very strong criticism of relativism, except that when stated in this way, it criticism begs the question on behalf of an absolutist conception of truth, and you need further argument to say that, to show that only an absolutist conception of truth is the workable conception. And that gets you back into the debate about Protagorean criticisms of Plato's criticism of Protagoras, etc. So that takes us very far away from this paper. So I'm putting that criticism aside, but I can admit that there is a lot to be said about this particular criticism. What about open-mindedness? Well, at some level, you can say that relativism is open-minded, but I have argued that this is actually misleading, because open-mindedness involves a willingness to step beyond one's existing epistemic commitment, including a commitment to the parameters or frameworks of our beliefs. And my claim is that a relativist cannot do that, because the relativist is stuck within her or his framework. She can switch to a different framework. That's possible for a relativist. But then she will be stuck in that framework, because the relativist does not accept that you can step out of all frameworks and look at different frameworks and compare them. Remember, that's the dependence thesis. If you are a relativist, you believe that you can judge things only from within your framework. Your framework is your default standpoint. But if you want to be open-minded, you really should allow that other frameworks can be also true while operating within your existing framework. And I'm arguing that that's not an option for the relativist. That's a controversial point, but I think it is. So the same goes for dogmatism. The relativist, by definition, cannot step beyond specific context of judgment on pain of violating the dependence thesis, and therefore the relativist is committed to the mantra to each according to her own epistemic stance, which sounds more like dogmatism. It's a curious form of dogmatism, because you then accept that others can be dogmatic about their own positions.
but it is still a form of dogmatism rather than.
And to his credit, again, I'm skipping a bit of this, the sort of problem was acknowledged by Richard Rorty. I've criticized Rorty for his relativistic stance, but he did acknowledge that, in a way, the relativism of what he did not want to call relativism does lead to what he labeled ethnocentrism. You end up saying that my position is better, you can't do it otherwise. And that's not open-mindedness. That's, as he used the term correctly, that's ethnocentrism. That's the last place you want to be if you want to have the virtues of anti-dogmatism and open-mindedness as such. So also the same goes for intellectual humility, because the relativist cannot really step out of his or her own stance to accept that the others may be doing better than she is or he is. She has to adopt a different stance, and that's not intellectual humility, that's just switching stances. So I won't go through all these various points in detail, but you can read either through the PowerPoint that I've sent or in the paper, but I've argued that if these arguments are successful, then relativism taken as a virtue-inducing philosophical stance is ultimately as unsuccessful as relativism presented as a philosophical doctrine. So then Martin Kusch comes in and sort of argues against many of my points. He, as I said, he did not argue against the view that relativism is a stance because he has started to share that position, but he has raised objections to other things. So here are a few PowerPoints from Martin's presentation at the joint session. I won't go through these with you, but you, as I said, I have shared them, and you can get copies if you like. But I'm just going to go to my responses to Martin, but in those responses, I am actually encapsulating my own restating Martin's criticism. So, one of the problems with the session we had at the joint session and the problem I have with relativism, and one of the reasons that I'm doing something else altogether now, and this might be one of my last talks on relativism, to be honest with you, is that there is a curse on relativism. Every time you talk about relativism, you have to start defining and redefining it, and then there's a discussion and debate about relativism. So I try to move away from that curse and that jinx by saying that, well, let's re-examine relativism and look at it as a stance rather than a doctrine. But of course, immediately when I did that, and I also knew it would happen, Martin Kusch objected to my definition of relativism, even though I had made it very minimal and I thought quite acceptable. So my attempt in this paper, the original paper, was to change the conversation about relativism and to break the curse on relativism. But I sort of should agree that it hasn't happened, but because I've ended up defending my definition of relativism. So many of my arguments in this paper have depended on accepting that or assuming that equal validity is a part of relativism. Kusch, contra Bagramian, argues that almost all car-carrying epistemic relativists deny being committed to equal validity. Anti-relativists, e.g. Bagramian, invariably regard equal validity as the very heart of relativism. My response to Martin is that this is just false, because Max Kobel is a card-carrying relativist, and he doesn't accept equal validity. Carol Robain, in her discussions of relativism of difference, where she defended a certain type of relativism, also supports equal validity. Rorty argued famously that it's not possible to choose or have to between the justificatory standards of Galileo and Bellarmine, and that was a form of relativism, and that is commitment to equal validity. Christian Wright, in his discussions of new relativism, has defended parity as a sign of relativism, and parity is Christian Wright's equal validity. So it's just not true that every car carrying on epistemic relativist denies the car committed to equal validity. Some of the most prominent car carrying relativists accept equal validity. So that's a textual difference between myself and Martin Bush. Then Martin Bush has two key objections to equal validity. The first objection, and these are from the PowerPoint slides that I have shared with you, but I didn't have time to go through them. You can look at what Martin exactly says, but I think I've been fair to him in representing his view. He says that the anti-relativist objection is that equal validity, being valid is not, being equally valid is not to be valid. So relativism is incoherent and it does not have a coherent conception of validity. And then Kush says that this begs the question against the relativist. For the relativist, the denial of absolute correctness is no denial of correctness per se. So he presents the anti-relativist position and then he denies the anti-relativist position. But I object to his presentation of the anti-relativist position and also to his argument against it. The accusation that the accusation that relatively right is not right goes back to Plato and can stand or fall irrespective of recent discussions of equal validity. So you might say that relativistic validity is not validity at all, but that is independent of the question of equal validity. The position held by Paul Bogosian, but not many other defenders of equal validity, is in line with what Kush is attacking, but not all critiques of relativism, including for instance myself and Annalisa Quadriva in our new book, hold to this Paul Bogosian view. Kush is not really attacking, is really running two different arguments together. Kush's second objection is that if you want to make a judgment about equal validity of epistemic framework, that would presuppose a perspective beyond other epistemic frameworks, and Kush's objection is that this is precisely the sort of perspective that the relativist denies. So the argument is that, and this is quite a crucial argument, he says that if you say that there is equal validity, you're taking a perspective outside of all perspectives, and you're saying something about relativism in general from a view from nowhere, if you like, and that begs the question against relativism. But although I see the point that Kush is making, and here he does have a serious point, the problem is that this point applies to every definition of relativism, including the five features of relativism that Kush himself accepts, and I have listed them on the PowerPoint and in the paper. Once you start saying anything about relativism in general, you are taking up a position from an outside position, a position. So, just here's a reminder. Kush accepts that dependence is a feature of relativism, non-absolutism is a feature of relativism, plurality is a feature of relativism, conflict is a feature of relativism. I'm basically agree on this, but we disagree on equal validity. But all these other five features, non-intrality, conflict, plurality, etc., these also, to talk about this, you're also stepping out and looking at relativism from an outside perspective. So my objection is that Hobbes, who allows himself to discuss dependence, for instance, or pluralism as features of pluralism without taking a perspective beyond all epistemic frameworks, and then thinks that when it comes to equal validity, you are taking a perspective that is unacceptable to a relativist. If he's right in his argument, then a relativist should not allow any general discussions of relativism, in which case it would mean that we cannot have any debate about relativism. And then the positive argument for equal validity or parity, as Crispin Wright called it, insists, and this is a very crucial point for me. Here are features of relativism that both Kusch and I accept. Plurality. There is more than one epistemic framework or standard of judgment. Every relativist accepts that. Conflict. Judgments resulting from different epistemic frameworks can conflict. And this is again something that all relativists and non-relativists accept. Non-neutrality. When epistemic judgments licensed by different frameworks conflict, then we have non-neutrality. And dependence, that there are no framework independent neutral ways of adjudication. So let's put all of these together, plurality, conflict, and non-neutrality. The conclusion you get is that conflicting judgments arising from incompatible standards have to stand because we have no means of ruling out one in favor of another. So you say there are plurality of views. These plurality of views conflict with each other. When they conflict with each other, we have no non-neutral way of adjudicating between them. You put these three together, you get equal validity. So I don't see how you can be a relativist and not to uphold equal validity. So if genuinely Martin Kusch wants to deny the role of equal validity, he has to modify at least one of his definitions of relativism. He has to give up either on plurality or conflict or non-neutrality. But if he gives up on any of those, there's no such thing as relativism. So he can't just deny equal validity and say a relativist. And that's sort of my zinger again. Now, there is a difference between strong and weak equal validity, and Kusch has stayed up on this. Strong equal validity says all judgments are equally valid. More sane equal validity says that, and this is a quotation from our new book by Gramian and Kaleva, in case of relativism inducing disagreement or differences, for instance, in case of judgments of taste, morality, and epistemic standards, incompatible judgments issued from different standpoints or frameworks would be both metaphysically and epistemically on par and cannot be ranked against one another. Moreover, their being on par should be appreciated by neutral and committed parties to a debate alike. So that's how we see equal validity. It's not that when you say judgments are equally valid for the relatives, you're not saying that relatives think that any belief is good. But there is a much more constrained way of defending equal validity. My contention is that it's difficult to make sense of relativism without hope. So, if you want to learn more about this, you can see the new book, Relativism by Bagramian and Kaleva, which is coming out in October. I think it's available on Kindle as well. So it's fine. I don't know whether you can download things in your own easily or not. So I think I will stop at that and would like to thank you for your patience. I went on longer than I had intended. Thank you. دونیم به وقت من یعنی 25 دقیقه من وقت دارم.
before. Vale. قطع میشه، یعنی صدا میاد ولی یه خود قطع میشه. صدای شما رو بدون قطع میشنوم. صدای بیشتر That's a very good question, and it is an important question to ask. So I think not, because historically, actually, for the example that I used in a few of my publications, I refer to it in this latest book as well, is that Mussolini saw himself as a relativist, and he defended relativism, and yet we know what he did. And also recently, well, the reasons that many relativists have turned their back on relativism is that you see arguments for based on a relativistic stance used by not Trump himself, but by defenders of Trump. Rudy Giuliani, for instance, comes on TV and in defending Trump, he says, "Well, truth is relative. So Trump has his truth and you have your truth, and so I'm subscribing to Trump's truth." So in that way, I think relativism does have, both in terms of case studies and also the sort of apparatus that's there, it can be used effectively by demagogues and also those with absolutist political tendencies. And absolutism in politics is obviously something that should be condemned, and I want to separate the two of them. On the other hand, the question of whether someone like Gandhi could be a relativist, I don't think so. That's a bigger argument. That's a longer argument. But someone like Gandhi, for instance, or the likes of him, Nelson Mandela, etc., if you look at their political positions, always there was a commitment to some values shared by all human beings. So they didn't think that equality of races is good in India but not good in Pakistan or whatever. So I think And this is a position that I strongly believe positive way of thinking about humanity and its future and evaluating its potential involves commitment to some universal virtues and values. So although I think your question is very pertinent and important to address, I think the answer to both sides of your question, from my point of view, is negative. That is, you can't be a Gandhi if you're a relativist. You can be an okay person. I know a lot of relativists who are very good people, so that's not the point. You can't be a Gandhi if you're a relativist, but you can be a Mussolini if you're a relativist, because he was a relativist. Hello. Thank you.
In case of adopting intellectual and moral virtues, what are the characteristics of relativism that prefer to skepticism? Thank you.
Right. So thank you. That is also a very good question. I didn't show my last slide, which was final word on relativism, virtue of tolerance. In that, so the best argument for virtues of relativism comes from this idea of tolerance, which was connects those to us. Are you okay? Is my voice coming all right?
Yeah.
So, as the previous question implied, you know, there is this connection between relativism and tolerance. A tolerant person like Gandhi might be relativist, etc. But I think the better connection between tolerance and other virtues is established not through relativism but through fallibilism. And fallibilism, of course, is strongly connected with skepticism. Fallibilism involves skepticism about the certainty that you might be inclined to have about your position. So to be a fallibilist, you always accept that any belief that you have is open to challenge, open to skeptical challenge, but other form of challenges. And then I also believe that as pragmatists pointed out, classical pragmatists and the neo-pragmatist philosophers, fallibilism is a prerequisite of good thinking. It's also a prerequisite of science. You accept in science that your theory should be open to falsification. And that's enough for us to be tolerant of other viewpoints, because we are engaging with them with an open mind, trying to show that maybe ours is better, but also accepting that their views might be better than that. I mean, you don't need to be a relativist to be a fallibilist. Just be a fallibilist. So I am connecting your question about skepticism to fallibilism, because the skeptical attitude is also a fallibilist attitude, and I am encouraging everyone to be a fallibilist rather than a relativist if they want the virtue of tolerance.
I personally have a question, and it's about the methodology. In the first part, you claim something about the relationship between relativism and intellectual virtue, either it's phase or not. But it seems that your methodology is to something like a conceptual analysis or mention some cases that relativism entails or not, for example, tolerance or other intellectual issues. But it seems that it's an empirical claim, actually, and it cannot be resolved by arguing either from your side or the other one. So I just wanted to know, what do you think about the need for some empirical work on the issue that whether relativism entails intellectual virtues or not? And also in the last part, when you say that to say relativism can be tolerant without appeal to equal validity, also it seems to me that it's an empirical claim. So it's not a philosophical claim, it's not a conceptual one. So we need to have the proper methods to validate such a claim.
I agree and disagree with your question, and it is an important question. I think the claim I'm making is not empirical, but it does have some empirical consequences. And if I remember correctly, I have a footnote about that. It could be the footnote maybe in the book rather than in the joint session paper. I just can't remember right now. So the conceptual part of the claim in terms of methodology is that if you see relativism as a stance, then stances are valued or are evaluated in terms of their consequences. So what are the consequences claimed for relativism by the relativists in analyzing their text? The consequences claimed by the relativists are in virtues such as open-mindedness, tolerance, etc. So that's based on textual evidence of what the relativists have said. You know, it's not what I am attributing to them, and I've tried to make that point. It's what Coates says, it's what Farben says, it's what Bloor says, Barbara Herrenstein says. So it is a claim, conceptual claim by the relativists. However, I do agree that you can have a comeback. It is possible to have a comeback on that, at least by saying that, okay, the fact is that if you are a relativist, you end up being a more open-minded and tolerant person. And that would be an interesting result. And there are some studies being done on that through experimental philosophy, but they have not been completed yet. There are mild correlations between relativism and open-mindedness, and as one would expect, but that would be empirically true. But I think it would not be a good result. What I would like to show those people is that, well, you don't need to be a relativist to be open-minded. If you want to be open-minded, be a fallibilist, not a relativist. So the empirical point would not contradict my conceptual point. But the empirical points will show that there's more work to be done to show to people that, in fact, relativism is not the good tool, the best tool for achieving tolerance. Fallibilism is a better tool for achieving tolerance. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Just wonder if there's any more questions. Zahran, do you have a question?
درگیر وقت شدم بودیم فرصت نکردم از شما تشکر میکنم. خیلی ممنون که قبول کردید که توی مدرسه تابستانی شرکت بکنید و به نظرم خیلی پیپر جالبی بود و در واقع ما در جریان یک بحثی که در سطح اصطلاح جامعه فلسفی برقراره گذاشت. امیدوارم که ایران هم تشریف بیارید و مؤسسه ما مؤسسه حکمت فلسفه هم
خیلی ممنون. اگر شد انشالله تونستم بیام به ایران، حتما با شما تماس میگیرم و یک سری میزنم به مؤسسه‌تون. خیلی خوشحالم انقدر جدی به فلسفه علاقه مندید و سوالای خیلی خوبی شد و امیدوارم همینطوری ادامه بدید به کارش سنگین و عمیق در فلسفه امروزه contemporary philosophy. خیلی ممنون.
خیلی ممنون. لطف کردیم. من خداحافظی میکنم.
خدا.
خیلی ممنون. به لحاظ برنامه البته یه مقداری هم عقب هستیم، ولی این 10 دقیقه رو اختصاص میدیم پرسش و پاسخ. از آقای دکتر شیخ رضایی خواهش می‌کنم تشریف بیارن. خب ما 3 تا پرسش داشتیم. آقای امیریارا هستن، شما بعد از آقای دکتر مسعودی.
من سوالی که داشتم الان به بحثی که خانم باقرامیانم کرد مربوط شد. اون سوالی هم که از آقای دکتر خداپرست کردم اون برای من باز پررنگ‌تر شد، یعنی این که مرز بین در واقع نسبی، چون از خود پرسش شوندگان که پرسیده نمیشه که نسبی انگار هست یا مطلق انگار، از نوع سوالاتشون بنابر تعریفی که اون طراح پرسش ها داره از نسبی انگاری مطلق انگاری میاره اونا رو دستبندی میکنه. این خودش اولا یه مشکلی به وجود میاره که ممکنه که نسبت فلسفه یک مقدار بی‌ربط بشه، ممکنه مثلا فلاسفه خیلی معتقد نباشن که اون در واقع کپچر کرده اون تعاریف اونها رو. و نکته دوم این که این موضع شکاکیت یا خطا پذیر بودن من اصلا حس نکردم که تا چند اندازه مهم هستیم، چون اون سوال اگه یاد درست خاطرم باشه اون اولتون راجع به این صحبت دارین که انگار نسبی انگار رو به کسی نسبت دادین عنوان رو که معتقد ممکنه بعضی چیزا درست باشن، ممکنه بعضی چیزا بعضیا درست بگم، ممکن این امکان در واقع یه مقدار شاید بی ربط بکنه به اون نسبی انگاری که ما تو فلسفه ازش صحبت میکنیم.
من اگه درست متوجه شده باشم شما سوالتون اینه که وقتی که اینا تبدیل به سوالای حالا این استثنان اینجا این کلمه عملیاتی درسته، چون اینقدر بی خودی به کار میره آدم دیگه کلمه رو نمیتونه درست به کار بره. به هر حال وقتی این سوالا آپریشنال میشه، میپرسن از آدما، ممکنه که اون تز اصلی اینجا گم بشه. این درسته، یعنی همیشه وقتی شما یه مفهومی دارید که میخوای اندازه‌گیریش بکنید که اندازه پذیر نیست، مثلا مفهوم شادکامی، مثل ایندیکیتوری پیدا میکنید اونا رو اندازه میگیرید، ممکنه که این ایندیکیتورها اونو به خوبی نشون نده یا خودش مدخلیت پیدا کنه و دیگه اون فراموش بشه. برای همین این درسته، یعنی یه نوع ضعف روشی برای این نوع تحقیقات اینه که آیا اینا به اندازه کافی اون تزی که فلاسفه میگن و به اصطلاح پوشش میدن، کپچر میکنن یا نه. این ولی یه سوال تکنیکاله، یعنی شما میتونید بگید دیزاین بهتری پیدا میکنم، موقعیت بهتری میسازم تا اونو بگید. ولی به هر حال تو این طراحی های اولیه کسی که بگه که دو نفر که اختلاف نظر دارن میتونن هر دو درست باشن، اینو به عنوان این میگیرن که نسبی انگاری رو باش همدلی داره. و اگه بگه نه حتما یک دست کم یکیشون بر خطاست، اینو طرفدار مطلق انگاری میگیره. اینو فعلا، ولی ممکنه شما بگین که خب این میتونه دقیق تر بشه یا به شکل بهتری آپریشنال بشه. آره
شنه. سوالی شما فکر میکردم دارم بیزاره قاطی شد با چیزایی که ایشون گفت. اون سوال اینه که واقعا آیا این چیزهایی که شما گفتید که مثلا یه دو از نسبی انگاران یا هر چی میگن که باید اینا رو تو مدرسه به مردم یاد داد، این چیزا اینا ربط مستقیمی به نسبی انگاری داره؟ یعنی این میتونه با همین خطا پذیری چیز باشه؟ با نمیدونم یه مکتب فلسفی که آدم میتونه بسنه پارشالیست مثلا
ده.
یه دانش ما جزئیست و ممکنه یه بخشاش پیش دیگران باشه، بنابراین ما باید حرف اونا رو گوش بدیم. با همه اینا سازگاره و میتونه به عنوان یک آدم ابسولوتیست به قول ایشون که جنس لویی 14 هم میتونه به عنوان استراتژی از این روش استفاده بکنه.
درست.
یعنی این هیچ عادت ممکن استدلال کرد که چنین اپروچی توی فضایی که از جمله سازن عناصر سازندش یک نسبی‌گرایی تقویت میشه. این ضرب موجهی است. ولی اینکه این حرفا ربطی با نسبی‌گرایی به عنوان یک دکترین داشته باشه من نمی‌بینم که بگم. یعنی با خیلی چیزای دیگه مربوط میشه، با ابسولوتیسم میشه مربوط باشه، با فرانسیسم مربوط باشه، با پارشالیسم مربوط باشه، هر چی. و این سوال دیگه برای من ایجاد میکنه، اون اینه که واقعا ابسولوتیسم به عنوان استنس اگر عناصرش اینها باشه چیز داره به عنوان استنس اگر عناصرش از چنین جنس هایی باشه باز میشه اونم پرسید که آیا این هیچ بچه مشترکی با رلاتیویسم به عنوان دکترین داره یا نه.
من حرفتون رو به شکل کلی قبول دارم ولی یه نکته استثنا. ببینید ایشون هم که مثلا داشت توضیح میداد میگه اونجایی که میگه که کسانی که میگن رلاتیویسم منجر به رواداری میشه، مثلا از فمینیستا یاد میکنه مثل اون خانم کد و دیگران که میگه که جنبش فمینیستی یعنی مقابله با یه جور نمیدونم سرکوب و انقیاد و اینا، بنابراین بهتر یعنی این هم یه نوع رلاتیویسمه به این معنای خیلی. اگه تو این معنای خیلی عام بگیریم نه، واقعا اون چیزا محدود به رلاتیویسم نمیشه، من قبولم. یعنی یک کسی میتونه کانتکستوالیست هم باشه و هم اونا رو بگه، حتی ابسولوتیست باشه ولی معتقد به خطا پذیری باشه اونا رو بگه، اینو قبول دارم. ولی بعضی از عناصر اونجا هستن که توی نظریه‌های رقیب انقدر اصلا یا مطرح نمیشن یا تاکید روش نمیشه، مثل چارچوب‌های فکری بدیل. مثلا یکی از اون پیشنهادها اینه که ما یاد بدیم و مهارت این که افراد در قضاوت اخلاقی حساس بشن به چارچوب‌های اخلاقی رقیب رو داشته باشیم. به هر حال ترم چارچوب اخلاقی یا فریمورک رقیب مال ابسولوتیسم و کانتکستوالیسم نیست. درسته که شما ممکنه اونجا هم بگید یه چیزایی بسازیم که اینو تقویت، ولی این ترم به هر حال مال رلاتیویسم. ولی من با این موافقم و چیز بدی نمیدونم اگه عنصر مشترکی باشه که حتی ابسولوتیستا رلاتیویستا اینا هم بگن باش ما تا این حدش با هم مشترکیم، چیز بدی نمیدونم. من قبول من تخصص من نیست ولی نظر شخصیمو دارم میگم. در حوزه تعلیم و تربیت اخلاقی مثل حوزه تعلیم و تربیت علمی باید یه موضع التقاطی داشت، یعنی حتما عناصری نسبی‌گرایانه لازمه برای تقویت همدلی و رواداری و حتما عناصری مطلق انگارانه لازمه برای تقویت عمل اخلاقی. و من التقاطی بودن رو تو اینجا بد نمیدونم. همونطور که شما تو آموزش علم نباید مثلا فقط به بچه ها بگین علم همونیست که پوپر گفته تموم شد. این التقاطی بودن اونجا خوبه، یعنی هر چقدر تو سطح بحث فلسفی اینا از هم متمایز میشن، ولی تو سطح ایژوکیشن اینا التقاط، من با این مشکلی ندارم. اسمش هم اگه نمیخوان ریلیتیویز بذارم مشکل، ولی میگم یه چیزایی از ریلیتیویز باید اونجا باشه، ولو اینکه از چیزای دیگه هم باشه، از ابسولوتیسم هم باشه.
یه در سوالم حاشیه‌ای از این جهت که شبیه اون سوالی که آقای امیری پرسید و آقای لاجوردی که تشکیک بکنه در مثلا روش شناسی اون اکسپریمنت ها و اینها، سوالم اینه که چون به نظر میاد که با توجه به شناخت و تصوری که ما از فلسفه داریم مثلا تو ایران، پرداختن به اکسپریمنت های اینطوری یه ذره مثلا عجیب و شاید نامعتبر باشه. میخوام ببینم به نظر خود شما یه همچین کاری یه جور تکمیل بحث‌های فلسفیه، یا اینکه نه به نظر شما جایگزین بحث‌های فلسفیه، و جواب شما به تشکیک‌های این موردی واکنش‌هایی که کلاً بخواد زیرا به آزمایشو بزنه چیه؟
آره این نوع تحقیقات چون نسبتاً اخیرم هست خیلی نقدای روش شناختی بهش شده، خیلی هاشون درسته، ولی باید یادمون باشه که بقیه تحقیقات تجربی هم وضع بهتری ندارن. حتی تو خود علم، حالا اونجا که ما فکر میکنیم ابزار دقیقی داریم، آزمایش دقیقی داریم، همین مسئله هست. نظر شخصی من میخوام حتی المقدور باید دقیق تر بشه، ولی این دقت همیشه یه حدی داره و این دقیق کامل نبودن به معنی این نیست که اینا به درد نمیخوره، ولی اینا هیچ وقت مکمل تفکر فلسفی نیست، چون که شما از دل اینا، از این داده ها میتونید یه جور تبیینی بسازید، یعنی فیلسوفه که نظری داره، یه کسی دیگه هم میتونه تبیین دیگری بسازه، هیچ وقت مثل همون علم تجربی است. باز ببین، باز من همش مثال علم تجربی میزنم. اگر شما نتایج اکسپریمنت رو بهش متعهد نیستی و اون اکسپریمنت درسته به لحاظ روشی، باید دلایلی داشته باشه که توضیح بدی چرا اینو کنار میذاری. یعنی اگه شما مثلا میبینی که وقتی که فریمورک رو وارد سوال میکنی مردم میرن به سمت ریلیتیویز بودن، اگه اینو میخوای کنار بذاری و همچنان بگی مردم طرفدار یه جور مطلق انگاری، بالاخره باید یه دلیلی داشته باشی.
خیلی ممنون از صحبتتون و ارائهتون. من دو تا سوال میپرسم، هر کدوم فکر میکنید که مناسبه و وقت میشه دوست کنید که توضیح بدید. یکی اون قسمت اول صحبتتون یه اشاره‌ای که اگه من درست متوجه شده باشم، اینکه کسی که داره به پرسشنامه پاسخ میده وقتی که دیدگاه‌های دیگران رو پی میبره بهش و متوجه میشه، دیدگاهش یه مقدار تغییر میکنه. و من استنباطم این بود که شما این رو یه دلیلی یا یه قرینه‌ای علیه ابجکتیویتی و آفاقی‌گرایی در نظر گرفتید. من میخوام ببینم که آیا اینجوری قابل توضیح نیست که ما بگیم که یک فرد وقتی میبینه مثلا 10 نفر دیگه هستن و اونا همتای معرفتیش محسوب میشن، وقتی متوجه میشه که اونا داوری متفاوتی دارن، یه دلیل به اصطلاح دیباد نظری نصیبش میشه برای اینکه دیدگاه اونا رو انتخاب بکنه، اختیار بکنه، نه به این معنا که دست از داوری اخلاقی خودش بکشه چون احساس بکنه که نه این ریلیتیو شده دیگه، به این معنا که نه احساس بکنه که همتایان معرفتی من دیدگاه مقابل رو برگرفتن، بنابراین اونا این خودش یه دلیلی به من میده برای اینکه اون دیدگاه درسته، آفاق لحاظ آفاقی درسته.
حالا اینو بگم چون یادم میره، حالا دو تاشو شما بپرس. ببین اون آزمایشه اینطوریه که میگه وقتی گفته میشه به آزمودنی که 2 نفری که اختلاف نظر دارن، یکیش به تو خیلی نزدیکه، یکیش از یک فرهنگ دیگه است، وقتی بهش گفته میشه یکیش از فرهنگ تو، یکیش از فرهنگ دیگه است، بعد ازش پرسیده میشه وقتی اینا اختلاف نظر دارن آیا ممکنه که حق با هر دوشون باشه، به احتمال بیشتری میگه حق با هر دوشونه. یعنی پرسشی که بعد از مواجهه با اینکه یه نفر از فرهنگ دیگه ازش میپرسن اینه که چقدر محتمله که هر دو درست بگن. و اون احتمال بیشتری میگه هر دو درست باشه. اگه این ایندیکیتور قابل اطمینانی باشه از میزان پایبندی به رلتیویزمش بیشتر میشه، نه اینکه تو نظر خودش تجزیه نظر کنه.
من عذرخواهی میکنم خیلی زیاد از امیرحسین عزیز و از بقیه هم، از هم خودم هم دوستانم اگر سوالی رو کات کردیم عذرخواهی میکنم، ولی سعی کردیم که روی تا حد امکان روی روال برنامه باشیم. من فقط یه نکته دارم که بعضی ها گواهیش رو نگرفتن، دست منه بعد از این جلسه هم بیرون عکس یادگاری با هم میگیریم. شما نکته ندارید؟ بازم از همه تشکر میکنم، از شما هم تشکر میکنم. فایلا رو روی کانال تلگرامی سعی میکنیم در چند روز آینده بذاریم به محض اینکه دوستان به ما بدن. امیدوارم در مناسبت‌های بعدی سخنرانی‌های علمی گروه که از مهر شروع میشه و احتمالاً یک ایونت دیگه در فصل زمستان در خدمتتون باشیم. از همه تشکر میکنم، ممنون، و به این وسیله ختم مرسه تابستانی استیون دایی.